Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. Today, Wildfile and Wyoming Public Radio political reporters preview the upcoming legislative budget session.
It might spell gridlock, and in fact, there are some lawmakers that have also publicly said that they would be perfectly happy with gridlock.
Maybe you've noticed your electricity bills going up. Well, state lawmakers are trying to address that in some bills they've drafted.
How do we better protect Wyoming utility customers from outside forces that may be impacting those utility rates?
When it comes to the Colorado River, there's not enough water to go around, but a historic piece of water ownership is about to change hands, and you can see it right off the side of the highway.
It holds the key for one of the most interesting and important water rates on the Colorado River.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards. It's that time of year again, time for lawmakers to assemble in Cheyenne for the legislative session. Wyoming Public Radio has partnered with Wyofile to bring you the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly roundtable of our political reporters. Today, they're going to preview this upcoming budget session.
This is the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Media and Wyofile. I'm Chris Clements with Wyoming Public Media's state government team.
I'm David Dudley, also with Wyoming Public Media's state government team.
And I'm Maggie Mullen, Wyofile's state government and politics reporter.
We're headed into week one of the budget session, which is only a month long. Timing is tight and lawmakers have lots to do. Maggie, you're a seasoned legislative reporter. What are the key things that people need to know?
Yeah, time is definitely limited. You know, they've just got 20 days and those deadlines do come quickly. So far, there's more than 200 bills that have been posted, so lawmakers already have a lot to sort through. That said, there's only one bill that they absolutely, positively, they are constitutionally obligated to pass, and that is the budget bill. Lawmakers have the responsibility of crafting a two-year budget every even-numbered year, so here we are. One other thing to know about this session is there are rules that are unique to a budget session. For example, and this is a critical one to know, every bill besides the budget bill needs two-thirds support in an initial vote in the chamber where it's introduced. So in the House, that's 42 members. In the Senate, that's 21 members. And for better or for worse, that's also where we will most certainly see a lot of bills come to their end.
And what about the budget will lawmakers wrestle with the most?
In a lot of ways, the big question will be to save or to spend, which is, you know, similar to the last budget session in 2022, but also, you know, just last year when lawmakers crafted the supplemental budget in 2023. In fact, it might be helpful to back up to 2022 because a lot of that is actually going to inform the budgeting that will take place this year. So the last time lawmakers had to hash out a two-year budget, mineral rebounds and stimulus funds had unexpectedly replenished state coffers after the pandemic had put Wyoming in some pretty dire straits. And while 2023 was more lucrative than state forecasters had predicted, the long term is still expected to be volatile. And I think that's going to set a lot of the tone. In fact, that was the tone of Governor Mark Gordon's his budget recommendations. He made that very clear in his letter. In fact, he called on the state to live within our means. And because of that, you know, certain cuts in Gordon's eyes are back on the table. And that, you know, is particularly true when it comes to the Department of Health. And that's also an area where the legislature and the governor are already sort of diverging a little bit. The Joint Appropriations Committee, or what you'll hear referred to as the JAC, they voted to fully fund the Department of Health's budget request, while Gordon, his proposal was about $20 million less than that. Last year, the governor and the legislature really landed on the same sort of fiscal note. So it'll be interesting to see if they do that again this year. You know, of course, it's worth mentioning that the Freedom Caucus is another part of this, and they have made it clear that they oppose Governor Gordon's budget recommendations. They recently made that clear in an opinion piece. They called his recommendations unaffordable and unsustainable. At the same time, they didn't really clarify if they would prefer those dollars to be saved. So that's another thing that remains to be seen.
So looking beyond the budget, what else seems to be the top priority?
Property taxes. In fact, residential property taxes will be priority number two, just behind the budget. That's at least what leadership has said. Speaker of the House Albert Summers and Senate President Ogden Driscoll said that much in an op-ed last month. And this is really picking up where the last session left off. Property taxes have shot up in a lot of the state because home prices, or I should say home values, have also gone up. And lawmakers tried to provide some relief and some reform in the last session, but it's fair to say that almost no one was very satisfied with those results, including lawmakers. They had about a dozen bills. They landed on three. One of those expanded the refund program. And the other two sort of laid the groundwork for some of these more ambitious reforms that they may take on down the road. So basically, they're going to try again. The Joint Revenue Committee also made property taxes its priority in the off-season or the interim. They settled, I think, on six different bills, including one to once again expand that refund program.
David, you've been looking into the draft property tax bills. Can you give us a brief taste of what changes are being proposed?
Yeah, there are a slew of property tax bills that I'm looking at. One of the ones that's most interesting to me is House Bill 4, which would expand a refund program meant to help homeowners pay their property taxes. And the way that bill may impact education bills. There, I'm looking at House Bill 19, the Education Savings Account Bill, which that proposes to give $40 million to low-income families to help pay tuition for private and parochial schools. And then it also feeds into health bills like House Bill 14, which aims to streamline the prior authorization process that can delay and raise costs of care.
So with all these various kind of proposals on the table, it sounds like compromise will be key. And that's not only true for property tax reform, but for anything lawmakers want to accomplish. Maggie, what are you hearing about lawmakers' ability to work together this session?
Yeah, that's actually something I'm really interested to watch, especially on the House side. And that's because, like I mentioned, we have this two-thirds rule on introduction. And while the Freedom Caucus in the House side, which is this one of the Republican camps, it's I would say the more hardline group of Republicans in the legislature, they don't have the majority in the House, but they do have about 26 members, which is enough if you do the math. It's enough to block bills on introduction. So they have this sort of newfound veto power. So it'll be interesting to see how they use that, if they're judicious with that, if they're a little bit more lavish with that. Because the other part of that is, because they don't have the majority, that means they need the support of non-Freedom Caucus members. So folks at the end of the day are truly going to have to work together if they're going to get anything done. And a lot of that will come down to the Republican Party, you know, being split between these two factions. There's the Freedom Caucus and there's the more traditional Wyoming caucus that recently formed in response, actually, to the Freedom Caucus. So it might spell gridlock. And in fact, there are some lawmakers that have also publicly said that they would be perfectly happy with gridlock. We heard that from Representative Mark Jennings. It should be interesting. Chris, I understand that you're going to be keeping an eye on wedge issue bills. So what can you tell us about that?
For sure. I mean, there's bills that regulate what students are taught in schools and that touch on issues related to LGBTQ residents, like the What is a Woman Act and others.
David, what are you going to be watching this session?
Well, I'm watching a lot of education bills, a lot of health-related bills. It's interesting that the property tax bills, they seem like a win for homeowners across the state, especially those on fixed incomes to help pay those taxes. But as I've been speaking with others, there's also some concern about the loss of local tax revenue, which helps pay for public services like roads and police, you know, emergency care. But they also help to pay for K-12 education, and they provide subsidies to hospitals. The education part is tricky because, you know, it may mean that the state will have to make up the difference from the general fund. You know, they're going to have to find a way to still fund education. but as you're aware, the Wyoming Education Association sued the state of Wyoming in 2022, alleging that the state failed to meet its constitutional obligation to fund education. And then that makes House Bill 19, you know, the Wyoming Savings Account Act, really intriguing. If that bill passes, it will provide $40 million to help low-income families pay for tuition at private and parochial schools. Those could be in the state, brick and mortar, or they could be online. And I'm told that a lot of those online programs are actually outside of the state. And so there are concerns about our taxpayer dollars going to fly out of the state. And then, of course, there are other critics that wonder why that money isn't being channeled into the public education system, especially in light of that pending lawsuit. And then where hospitals are concerned, you know, healthcare leaders have faced all kinds of challenges from staffing their facilities, which, you know, they've talked a lot about raising wages to recruit nurses. But they're also struggling to stay fiscally solvent, just keeping their doors open. And another one to watch is House Bill 108. That aims to provide protection to healthcare professionals who they've seen an increase in attacks over the years, especially since COVID. If passed, that bill will introduce legal consequences for those who attack healthcare workers who are caring for them. A lot of really interesting stuff to watch. And Chris, how about you? What will you be watching?
One bill that comes to mind is House Bill 63, which would outlaw surgeries for trans kids in the state. It's one of several politically divisive bills that have been filed by lawmakers that I'll be monitoring. Another is House Bill 50, otherwise known as the What is a Woman Act. I mentioned that before. Under Wyoming law, that bill would categorize people based on the biological sex shown on their birth certificates and would prevent transgender people from being legally recognized as any other gender. Critics say that these bills restrict the civil rights of LGBTQ residents in a state that, until recently, obviously had a long history of defeating such legislation. But as you pointed out, Maggie, these bills will need a two-thirds majority just to be introduced this session, and that seems kind of like a steep road to climb at this point. I'll also be tracking bills that would change election laws and guidelines in the state, like House Bill 38. It's been filed to be introduced to the House and would pretty much mean that if you want to register to vote in an election in Wyoming, you need to have already been a resident for 30 days prior to that. Some lawmakers have said that the bill could add another obstacle for voters in the state. But one clerk I spoke with, however, said that the residency requirement could help shield them from accusations by citizens that they're not stopping non-residents from voting. The bill wouldn't mean that voters need to bring additional identification, just that they would need to sign an updated oath when registering that indicates they've been a resident for at least 30 days. Poll workers and election officials have been under increased scrutiny in recent years following the attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Maggie, any other interesting political dynamics you're planning to watch?
Yeah, you know, it remains to be seen how much the governor will assert himself in the legislative process. Traditionally, Governor Gordon has taken a hands-off approach, and you can really see that in, for example, the way he has, in his line item vetoes in previous budgets, for example. You really only see those in the places where he felt like lawmakers were improperly legislating within the budget. In the last few months, some in his own party have targeted the governor pretty fiercely, particularly for, his long touted energy policies. So it'll be sort of interesting to see how that may or may not change dynamics. On the other hand, the Constitution does sort of provide some guardrails. For example, it's unconstitutional for the governor to, quote, menace any lawmaker by the threatened use of his veto power. So there are some limitations already in place, but, it's always interesting to be there in Cheyenne and to see in person, how those things play out.
Thanks, Maggie, and thanks, David.
Thanks, Chris.
Throughout the budget session, Wyoming Public Media and Wildfile will bring you the Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers are up to during the 2024 legislative session. You can subscribe to the Cheyenne Roundup wherever you get your podcasts, or follow the ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wyofile.com. Thanks for listening.
Or you can listen on Monday mornings on Wyoming Public Radio. In our next segment, we'll learn what lawmakers hope to do about rising utility costs. This is Open Spaces. Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on The Newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Let's dive in for a closer look at one of the issues facing lawmakers during this budget session. If you pay an electric bill, there's a good chance you've noticed the cost going up. There's a lot of reasons why. Everything from a volatile fossil fuel market to extreme weather to efforts to save Wyoming's coal industry. So state lawmakers are proposing several bills for the upcoming budget session. They aim to keep rates affordable and electricity reliable. But some say these efforts could just muddy the waters. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan takes a look at how we got here and what to expect during the session.
Many of these bills sprang out of a historic rate hike request this past year. The state's largest utility, Rocky Mountain Power, proposed an almost 30% increase to Wyoming customers' electric bills, and a lot of people were horrified. Tony Bate of Rock Springs spoke at a public meeting this summer.
My electric bill will raise $86 a month. I have hardly any money. I don't know where I'm going to get the money to pay this. I just can't do it.
Increasing costs is a real burden to people, and the Wyoming Public Service Commission tries to balance that burden while also being fair to the utility, like allowing them to recoup costs and make a little profit, too. The commission's chair, Mary Throne, explained in a past meeting that they can't negotiate better deals for ratepayers.
When the evidence supports a rate increase, the commission lacks the authority to deny the application for such rate increase.
Ultimately, Rocky Mountain Power's giant rate hike request was scaled back, partly due to a calculation error on the company's part. Customers saw about a 5.5% increase to their bills starting this year. But the threat of such a giant rate hike was too close for comfort, and lawmakers decided to get involved.
All right. Welcome to another special session.
Representative Jared Olson of Cheyenne led a committee meeting this fall.
We've got a pretty aggressive agenda in front of us. We do have us working through the morning.
The lawmakers spent days crafting six draft bills that attempt to regulate what kind of costs a utility can pass on to its customers. Attorney Shannon Anderson is with the Powder River Basin Resource Council and has tracked the bills closely. She says they're a good faith effort.
Sort of trying to address the issue of how do we better protect Wyoming utility customers from outside forces that may be impacting those utility rates.
But Anderson says to some extent, the Public Service Commission is already doing what's in these bills.
The legislators just need to kind of let them do that job. And to some extent, they're just further complicating an already complicated system.
Like Senate File 22, which requires the state to create standards for what is reliable electricity.
So this one, you know, comes from the idea that, and really the misperception to some degree, that grid more dependent on renewable energy is going to be less reliable for customers.
Basically, concern over how consistent wind and solar power can be. Some lawmakers think that traditional coal power is the more reliable route. And several of the other bills also get at that mistrust of renewables. Then there's other bills that try to prop up fossil fuel sources, like Senate File 25, which deals with utilities retiring coal plants.
With that, there comes some uncertainty around the actual decommissioning costs of those coal plants.
So the bill requires a third party to study what the actual costs might be, allocating $500,000 of state money to do so, which Anderson says likely isn't enough.
It's really duplicative of what the utility already does, what the utility commission already has oversight over.
So the broader concern is that by further regulating utilities, it could have unintended effects. Sam Shumway is with AARP and represents a lot of Wyoming ratepayers.
Something that looks like on its face is going to benefit consumers, but ultimately, you know, it just increases cost for the utility, who then turns around and passes that on to the consumer, and it ends up increasing costs for the ratepayers.
But Shumway says if lawmakers can get it right, the bills will give the Public Service Commission more tools to scrutinize how utilities
pass those costs on to ratepayers, to consumers, and ultimately to protect the ratepayers.
Now, if your head is spinning from all this utility talk, Shumway says you're not alone.
Like, it gets super technical, and I barely scratched the surface with the things that we're talking about here.
Lawmakers will dig in over the next few weeks of the session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan.
To learn more about all six bills, go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. And for an even more in-depth explanation, check out wyofile.com. Now, turning to another critical issue in our region, water. Competition for water on the Colorado River is intense. There's not enough to go around. So when a large volume is up for negotiation, it draws in some powerful players and big money. KUNC's Alex Hager reports on one deal coming together in Colorado.
Amy Moyer is standing under a busy highway, pinched in a dramatic snow-covered canyon. On one side, the rushing Colorado River churns with whitewater. On the other, a chain-link fence blocks off a building that looks like a warehouse with electrical wires and big metal pipes coming out of it.
It is a nondescript brown building off of I-70 that most people don't notice when they're driving.
Moyer is with the Colorado River District.
But if you are in the water world, it holds the key for one of the most interesting and important water rates on the Colorado River.
This is the Shoshone Hydroelectric Facility. And even though it uses a lot of water, it returns every drop back to the Colorado River. And that means it's not just a hydropower plant.
It spins through the turbines and then goes back into the river to be used for habitat, to be used for recreation, to support cool, clean water for drinking water and productive agriculture on the West Slope.
Shoshone is a big reason why water keeps flowing to cities and farms along the river in Colorado. Moyer's Group is a taxpayer-funded agency founded to protect Western Colorado water. It's spending big bucks to buy the rights to the water and lease it right back to the power company, XL Energy, all to make sure that water keeps flowing, even if the power plant goes offline.
It's so much more than we're going to spend $100 million to do nothing. We're keeping the native flows in the river for so many benefits on the West Slope.
Moyer's Group isn't just keeping water here, they're keeping it away from the people on the other side of the mountains. Fast-growing cities and suburbs around Denver get their water supply piped over from the Colorado River. For decades, Western Colorado has been anxious that their east side neighbors will snatch up the plant's water for themselves. So even with a $98.5 million price tag, buying Shoshone is a huge sigh of relief for the Western Slope. And the biggest beneficiary?
Anything that results in more water in the river is good for fish.
Further downstream in Grand Junction, Dale Ryden with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service looks out over a murky, meandering stretch of the Colorado River, home to endangered fish.
It's a competition between people, between agriculture, between recreation, and between the natural world to all try to survive and coexist.
By buying the Shoshone water right, the River District is trying to take some of the heat out of that competition. And it's already working. Tina Berganzini runs the Grand Valley Water Users Association.
We can't have farming without taking care of those fish. They go hand in hand.
The Endangered Species Act says people who use water from the river are legally required to leave enough behind for fish. If they don't, they have to turn off their own sprinklers. So if the water from Shoshone keeps flowing where fish need it most, farmers and ranchers don't have to worry.
I think peace of mind is the number one most important thing. It's just peace of mind of knowing that we're going to be able to divert.
It's not every day that a big money Western water deal brings together fish lovers and farmers, not to mention about 20 other local governments and nonprofits that pledge their support and money for the Shoshone purchase. Lauren Riss is the state's top water official.
I don't expect that there's going to be entities or individuals that come out of the woodwork, you know, vocalizing any strong opposition to us moving forward in this way.
Access to water is a hotly debated topic around the region, and any kind of deal that gives a lot of people some decades-long security about who gets to use it, that's going to get a big base of support. Again, the River District's Amy Moyer.
I think now more than ever, there is a desire to look for long-term permanent solutions on the Colorado River, and this is one that exists for Colorado.
In a time of deep uncertainty about the river, this big money deal lets at least some water users put to bed decades of worry. In Glenwood Springs, Colorado, I'm Alex Hager.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. After the break, we'll visit with young musicians hoping to win a chance to play with the UW Symphony Orchestra. This is Open Spaces. This time on The Modern West, our Facebook Live panel discussion on how to prepare for an urban wildfire. We talked to folks from the Burn Scar and the former mayor of Paradise, California.
In Paradise, what the fire didn't take was the sense of community that exists there. Our mission was, look how far we've come, and it was a vision to the future.
Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation. Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards. At the end of January, students participated in the Wyoming Symphony Orchestra's Young Artist Competition at Casper College. It's one of three main student classical solo competitions in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Saunders reports on the two winners and its impact on student musicians in Wyoming.
That's Tarji Grover, a pianist and winner of the collegiate division, playing the first movement of Sergei Rachmaninoff's Concerto No. 2. A concerto is when an orchestra plays with a solo musician who is featured and plays in the very front. Grover played that part for his submission. He's a first-year graduate student at the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. The competition is only open to people who are residents of Wyoming or who are undergraduate students in the state. Grover was able to enter because he grew up in Powell.
Being able to really bring back the efforts and the work that I have put in to the state where I grew up and hopefully be able to, you know, give a performance that people I know and friends from back home are going to be able to listen to and appreciate is definitely something important to me.
Grover has been playing piano ever since he was 6 years old, taking lessons in the local area. He had participated in the last Young Artist Competition, which was 2 years ago, earning the runner-up prize.
It's a great opportunity for Wyoming natives and students who go to school at the University of Wyoming to be able to prepare a concerto and compete it by a group of accredited judges and have the opportunity to be able to perform with a group as special as the Wyoming Symphony.
The Wyoming Symphony is an audition-only professional orchestra, which means most students are not going to have the experience of playing with musicians of that caliber. Winners of the competition get to. Grover says the Young Artist Competition helps other students share their efforts with friends, family, and other Wyomingites.
I think that a lot of times music in Wyoming is sometimes overlooked.
Plus, he says it can bring together musicians in the large and rural state.
People from within the state have to go outside their immediate locale to find opportunities, but this is an opportunity that's great, built within the state of Wyoming, by the state of Wyoming.
Students in high school can also participate in a separate group. Elisa Lee, a sophomore cellist at Laramie High School, won the division. She competed at the last Young Artist Competition, but didn't win.
So I tried again this year, kind of on accident, because my teacher just pulled up her camera. I was like, okay, we're going to record your piece and enter you in this other competition.
You're hearing that video now. Lee played Pezzo Capriccioso by Pyotr Tchaikovsky. Lee says she enjoyed the intensity and diverse range of the piece. Lee has never played with a professional orchestra before, but she's looking forward to playing her concerto with the Wyoming Symphony.
I think it's going to be a really interesting experience, and not many people get this opportunity, so I think it's going to be pretty fun.
13 students competed in both high school and collegiate divisions. To apply, they had to send in a recording of them playing a solo from a concerto. Rebecca Hebert, the executive director of the orchestra, helped organize the event. She says every student that participated received comments from judges.
Feedback is valuable, and all of these students are trying really hard to be better musicians. You can tell they all work incredibly hard at their instrument, so we just felt it's important to do a little something to help them along their way.
In addition to getting feedback and playing with the orchestra, the winners can earn a cash prize. Hebert organizes a lot of events for her job, but...
I really love this competition. I think it's my favorite thing I do.
And she agrees with Grover, the collegiate winner.
It's really inspiring to see these talented musicians we have in Wyoming. I don't think that they have enough opportunities to really show what they're capable of. So I'm very excited that we can give them a chance to do that.
The concert where Grover and Lee will perform their submissions will be held on May 11th at 7:30 p.m. at Natrona County High School's John F. Welsh Auditorium in Casper. The next Young Artist Competition will be held 2 years from now. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Saunders.
Betsy Gaines Quammen is the author of a new book titled True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. The book explores polarization, extremism, and the impact of the pandemic on the landscapes and communities of the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke with Quammen about what she learned in the process of writing the book.
True West starts with a scene of an ice cream truck slowly winding through an empty, smoky block during the wildfire-heavy summer of 2021. Then you describe the historic flood that washed through Yellowstone National Park the next summer. In addition to this increase in extreme weather events, what are some of the other big changes that you've seen taking place throughout the West?
So we're on the front lines of climate change. As you said, you know, we have the droughts, we have the fires, we have the floods. And I think in particular during pandemic and polarization, the West became this sort of idea for people, a place that really was a mythological landscape. And we saw people coming here because they'd seen the show Yellowstone. And all of a sudden, they were envisioning, you know, wide open spaces and ultra freedom, these notions that have been attached to the West. We were also seeing people thinking, oh, the West is a safe and healthy place. Let's head out west where we can be outside and be away from the pandemic. As a result, the pandemic was brought to small Western towns, putting pressure on small Western health clinics. This is a mythology that goes back even to tuberculosis, people coming out west, looking at the West as a place to heal tubercular lungs. The other thing that happened that I talk about is that the West became a lure for people seeking homelands. And this really ties into the work that I do on extremism, that the West became this place. And I say became, it has been this for a while, that this is a place where people are coming to build like-minded communities. And you see this quite a bit in Western Montana, in the Idaho Panhandle, and in Wyoming too. You know, this is a place where let's await the second coming, or let's get ready for a civil war. That, you know, goes back to these ideas that the West is a blank slate, which of course we know it's not. Not only was it not a blank slate when that was sort of promoted by Manifest Destiny and this whole movement to say, come out West and buy your little homestead and create a farm or a ranch, you know, rain follows the plow, that myth. And then it came up again, it's been reiterated and reiterated. And during COVID, it was, let's move west and create a new life. We can work remotely. And it plays into this mythological or these myths that people had about the West.
Your book is filled with so many stories and interviews with people from a really wide range of both political perspectives and just different backgrounds. For you, what was an interview or two that really stood out, and why did it stand out to you?
Oh, wow. I had so many interviews with people that surprised me, and I love that about it. I went and spoke with the director of the Creation Museum in Montana. It labels itself a dinosaur museum, and it is a Christian explanation of the Old Testament. And it says that the earth is 6,000 years old and that humans and dinosaurs lived on the earth at the same time. When I was talking to the director there, who actually was very, very open about everything except for talking about climate change. He did not want to talk about climate change, but he had gotten vaccinated. And I was surprised. I mean, that was something that I had to sort of reconsider my assumptions in terms of what people, you know, were doing and how they were reacting to pandemic.
I'm curious, from your experience writing this book, what were some tools or tricks that helped you connect with people, helped you listen, have these conversations?
My first sort of contact was a woman who worked with various communities throughout the rural West. And she started to introduce me to people. And then those people introduced me to people. And then those people introduced me to people. So I had unbelievable opportunity with networks. And then I would just call people and say, you know, do you want to meet me for a cup of coffee and just chat about anything you want to chat about? I mean, I was saying, you know, I'm really interested in polarization and your take on that. I was very clear about me and my particular beliefs, but I wasn't arguing with anybody. I was just asking them questions. And I think there was something about that moment in time where people had not been talking to other people outside of their little bubble. People just wanted to talk. And so I'm not sure I have any specific skills other than I was just there. And I was really interested. So I think it's important to remember that although there are a lot of people out there that are benefiting from our polarization, and I'm talking about politicians, I'm talking about clickbait, some of the polarization we can get around.
We've talked some about myths, and you are just sort of touching on this concept of mending. How can we get around that polarization or rebuild those connections? And are there other things that you think could help heal some of these deep divides and maybe correct some of these misunderstandings throughout the West?
When I talked about myths, I really am talking about it from the standpoint of expectations of a place that doesn't exist. I really do think that the idea of endless resources and the idea of manifest destiny and the idea of an empty landscape and the idea even of wilderness as an unpeopled place. I mean, we know that Indigenous people have been out here. They're not places that are untrammeled, even though I think that those of us living in and around so much public land, white people who started these preservation movements that really had intentions of protecting landscape, but leaving out the history of Indigenous people, it is a really, really important myth to confront and to, you know, deconstruct. So there are things that we need to acknowledge, or we're living in a place of toxic myths, and that's not a healthy way to live in the West.
Betsy, is there anything we haven't touched on that you want to add to our conversation?
When I talk about the book, one of the things that I am not able quite to communicate is that, number one, it's supposed to be funny. And so I want there to be the recognition that we were living through an incredibly dark time and continue to live through really, really a difficult period. But I wanted there to be a lightheartedness. And I do feel like that happens when we're in relationship with each other. I mean, one of the things that we do have in common is a sense of humor. And so that was an important piece of this book, because it does cover so many heavy and important topics, from colonialism to stolen land to, you know, these politics that are ripping us apart, to what QAnon did to families. And I talk about, you know, wolves and wildlife and public lands and polarization. And there's so many topics that actually wrapped up together in ways that were daunting. I mean, I really look at the interconnectedness of all these things in the West, but I also hope that it's a fun book to read.
I've been talking with Betsy Gaines Quammen, who's the author of the new book titled True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. Betsy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Next up, we'll hear two Wyoming sports stories. That's when we return to Open Spaces.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. Let's take a look at some news in Wyoming's sports communities. This past season, the Wyoming volleyball team won 22 of 32 games, which was a significant change from last year's season when they only won 10 games. Wyoming Public Radio's Peyton Holstrom reports on how that's thanks to a new head coach who helped boost team chemistry.
On a Friday evening, the volleyball cowgirls are at the gym in Laramie practicing. New head coach Kaylee Prigg is encouraging competition in the scrimmage. A cowgirl spikes the ball over the net, earning her team a point, and all 12 women on the court cheer. This is the energy that the cowgirls had the entire 2023 season, and it's because they finally felt like they were back on their feet. After COVID struck, the cowgirls took a hit.
2019 was a successful season, and we really struggled for kind of the COVID season and the season after that to kind of re-find ourselves and re-establish ourselves.
That's Kaylee Prigg. She became the head coach in 2023, and she knew it was time for the team to find themselves again. Prigg wanted to re-establish their cowgirl toughness.
What worked for us so well early when I got here was like a blue-collar mentality that really aligned with, in my mind, who Wyoming is.
And they did that by practicing hard in the gym, but keeping that balance of having fun together outside of practice. Sether Macy Boggs is a senior this year. She says the new mentality really changed things.
Our team chemistry definitely improved. During the spring, we focused a lot on doing things outside of volleyball together. Just throughout the summer, we spent time hanging out like at the pool every day or going to Jubilee Days and just things around the town.
Boggs says that the change of coach was definitely different for the chemistry of the team and their gameplay.
Kaylee came in and she decided to make a big culture change. And then our assistants were also amazing and they came in and changed the whole offense.
The thing is, Prigg isn't new to Wyoming. She's been part of this team since 2019 as an assistant coach. Prigg says she had a leg up.
Not very often do first-time head coaches get to be in a program that they already understand. And having been an assistant here for 4 years before being the head coach, I already kind of knew everything else from just being familiar with our program and having been here. So that really helped.
Prigg says how here at Wyoming and with this team, the players are able to find similarities and common building ground, which continues to make the team stronger as a whole.
At Wyoming, if you are a diva, if you are super high maintenance in the recruiting process, like Wyoming is not even appealing to you. So those kids are gone. And we end up with a core group of kids that are really pretty down to earth and maybe have more in common on day one. And we love that, like a little bit more willing to cooperate and be a little bit more blue collar. I think that really helps us from a team chemistry standpoint as well.
Prigg's coaching and changes worked. The Cowgirls ended their 2023 season with one of their best records from the past 3 years. Their standing was close to making the conference tournament, but not enough. They were invited back to the postseason National Volleyball Invitational Championship, though, for the first time since 2019. Prigg says that this opportunity gave the Cowgirls more time to show off their abilities.
We were clicking on all cylinders and we were peaking at the right time, and I knew any sort of postseason opportunity, buyer beware, that we were coming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we felt really good going into it, so was just excited for this team to not be done.
Middle blocker Sarah Holcomb, who is a sophomore this year, agrees with Prigg.
It felt like all the hard work that we put in through the year actually paid off and we got to show off a little more. Even though like this season didn't go exactly how we wanted it to, we got to end it in a good positive note, which is what we worked for.
Boggs, Holcomb, and the Cowgirls are taking this break before next season to continue to grow as a team.
Building off of what we created last year, like talent-wise, I know we have a lot of talent this year, and keeping the culture and going off of everything that we accomplished last year.
And a little bit more of a like measurable goal, we want to make it and compete at the conference tournament this year.
Although Prigg is happy with this past season's outcome, she says there's still room for improvement with specific techniques on both the offensive and defensive side.
So the spring is some really cool like volleyball technical time to really get to break some things down and make some big changes. And just excited about that growth that is ahead of our team right now.
Back at the gym, the team huddles after a hard-working practice.
Cowgirls on three, 1, 2, 3!
The Cowgirls are going to continue practicing on and off the court until their conference season starts in September. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Peyton Holstrom.
For the majority of Jacksonites, their main winter activities involve skiing or snowboarding, though some have another sport to keep them busy, broomball, which has been kicking in the region for a quarter century. But as Jackson Hole Community Radio's Erica Dalby reports, the Parks and Rec League almost didn't happen this year.
Yeah, nice job, nice job.
It's a bitter cold night at the Teton County Fairgrounds. About 24 people have gathered to play broomball on the rodeo arena turned ice rink, risking frostbite and injury for the weekly league. Gary Duquette is wearing a ski helmet and baseball pads. He's practicing shots into the goal. The broomball veteran says the sport is ironically not played with brooms.
Broomball is like hockey with sneakers, with a lacrosse stick pushing a soccer ball into a goal.
Similar to the equipment, the rules of the game pull from a lot of sports. It's like controlled chaos on ice. Techniques include a shuffle, a prance, a sprint, and a full body slide. None of which are graceful, according to another longtime player, Sam Fitz.
It's a goofy sport. I mean, you're running around the ice without skates, and you can see the best athletes moving around, and the ball goes in a different direction, and everyone sort of looks like Wile E. Coyote running down the road when he sees the roadrunner going the other way.
But tonight's game, and the whole season, were almost canceled due to low turnout.
There were some question marks rolling into the new year.
The sport used to be a lot more popular. Gary Duquette says back when he started playing almost 25 years ago, there were two leagues with almost 50 teams. This year, only four.
I mean, it used to be like the biggest thing in the winter in Jackson.
But the sport is still attracting some new players.
Oh, I didn't know this was a sport.
Natalie Keesaw says she showed up to play for the first time with only a few hours' notice.
And I've already slipped on the ice fully.
Despite that, Keesaw says she's excited to get on the ice and have something to do after work with friends. And that a slippery playing field is the ultimate equalizer. For KHOL News, I'm Erica Dalby.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. All the stories that you heard today can also be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And Open Spaces is also a podcast, and it can be downloaded wherever you like to get your podcasts. Thanks to Caitlin Tan, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer, for today's show. And to Eric Vigil, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.